important thing.
Well, hey, welcome everybody. This is Dave. As you know, this is our final seminar on the New Money Story, and we're going to talk about the final two steps in the roadmap about authoring new experiences and program new identity to incorporate and sustain the changes. There's some additional things that I want to discuss as well. And first, though, I want to see what kind of questions or thoughts or reflections you have about any of the first three seminars. Any clarifications or questions or just anything you have in response to those? For those of you especially who sent in the most important question and what you'd like to walk away with, where are you in that process? I took those very seriously, and I know we're not done, but are you getting what you had hoped to get from our collaboration together? Yes, no, maybe? Any thoughts or responses? It would be helpful for you to know. Yes, go ahead, please.
Hi, Dave, can you hear me?
Please, go ahead.
Oh, you can hear me. Okay.
Yes.
This is Carolyn. Actually, I got a lot out of this. I know it's a short four call session, but really allowed me to kind of take a deep, reflective look. I think I mentioned this a little bit last week, but, you know, I never really considered that I had a particular type of relationship with money, and as I told you about the comment, and I've really, since taking your class, I really am actively working on it. Whenever I find myself, you know, going back to this mindset, I can't explain the mindset, because I didn't realize that I was in it, because I guess it's the pattern.
Okay.
It's just, yeah, you know what I mean? Like, the pattern is just the pattern.
Yeah.
Like, wait a minute, I didn't think this applied to me, but I am working on it actively and feeling a lot better about it. So
okay.
I saw that you had a book online that can kind of take me to step two of this. So I'm looking forward to reading it.
Okay. All right. Super. Well, that's good. Thank you for that feedback. And that's a common experience of anyone who goes through mentor coaching. We first become aware of our own stories and understand them, and then we're in the very best position to be a catalyst to help our clients develop their stories and to know what may be the best kind of things to offer other people beyond our clients, because we're informed by the seeming paradox of being more subjectively aware of ourselves and more objectively aware at the same time, and those go hand in hand. And this is exactly what we foster with our clients, to develop an empathy with themselves so that they are understanding more of what they think and feel and experience. And, you know, we talked about the operating systems that we have, that 90 to 95% of our operating systems are behavioral patterns and belief systems that get downloaded from parents in the first years of life and become automatic and are influenced by all kinds of sources and input. 90 to 95% is unconscious. So it's understandable that this is a process of self-discovery. And, you know, we rarely see this actually, but we see the behavior, we see the result of it, and we can infer the algorithms. And that's exactly what this process, the roadmap, is a kind of macro system to understand and deconstruct a story, to understand the algorithms of how we construct our stories in order to understand and see what we may want to keep, what we may want to enhance, and what we may want to change. So that process is simply just a way of listening and deconstructing a story and knowing how to go about instituting a change if we decide to, because that's where we apply, in my view, most meaningfully the mind and brain sciences to understand how the mind and brain work to create changes that last. And that's the big difference, and that's what we're going to talk about in today's seminar, is the last step, program new identity. As we just touched on before, the most powerful force of the human psyche is that we return to our fundamental identity. If you put 10 items in front of somebody and hook them up to an fMRI machine and get them to look sequentially at each of the 10, you can tell the one they're going to purchase, because it's the one that activates the area of their brain that has to do with the sense of self, with identity. We touched on this before, and I know I'm reiterating, but we always return to our identity. That's why, as mentor coaches, we want to help someone transform how and who they see themselves to be, their bedrock of identity, along with the changes they're making, because that's how changes become permanent, when it's incorporated into identity, because it becomes then the default mode. So part of that may be having an awareness of the kinds of processes that go on in our operating system. We're going to talk more about that. But thanks for that observation and reflection out loud about that. I hope that's a shared experience as we begin to. It's not always comfortable to do that, because it's easier to repeat. Even if it doesn't create what we want, it's easier because we know the outcome. And, you know, repetition can masquerade as effectiveness. So thanks very much for that. Other comments or questions or reflections about your experience of these seminars? Anything else?
Hi, Dave.
Yes, go ahead, please.
Hi, this is Joy. I was the one who, I had the wrong idea about the course, but I am pleasantly surprised and grateful. Just as the other young lady said, without being redundant, this has actually, it actually hits the center point of what I believed. Unfortunately, it seems like I was acting out something differently. Being able to identify with the source of my spending habits, you know, how I relate to money. And it's very funny that it seems to become a part of me now. Even when I'm thinking, and the young lady said this, when I go to make purchases, or I'm even looking at monthly responsibilities, how I'm actually looking at money and having a focused experience, if you will, now, I'm actually like out of body saying, now how would you relate to that in the past? And how are you relating to it now? And can you identify the different thought patterns? So as you spoke about those new pathways that you make to the, you know, through the brain when you're adopting or selecting a new default, it's very apparent to me now, you know, even in conversation, even with my children when they are asking for certain things. It's a different process now, and I'm grateful that it's starting with me and that I can later be able to share this with clients.
Thank you very much for that, Joy. This seminar is for me a kind of choose your own adventure, because there are a couple of things I want to be sure and cover, but then I thought that based on comments or questions or reflections about it, that there are some things I could include if there may be interest, and that tells me there's something I specifically want to include that will be dedicated to Joy here about the opportunity cost of money. It's one of the selective electives that I want to spend just a few minutes on, and thank you for that comment, Joy, because I think from that you and others will benefit from that, because it sort of is a way to look a little bit more closely at the choice architecture of our seemingly automatic decisions, and especially about money and just some different ways to think about things. So thanks very much for that, and we will definitely come back to that. Other questions or thoughts or reflections?
Hi, Dave. This is Victor.
Hey.
Hi. I assume, like, I haven't been through too much of the book, you know, that came with the course, just through a little bit of it. But my understanding, I guess, obviously I need to use this for me before I can teach it or coach someone else on it, you know, kind of the walk your talk thing. But it seems like it's like a skill in and of itself. You know, like for me, I put all this time into skill acquisition for day trading. But my money story, it's almost like it's holding me back, you know, because what am I then drilled in me when I was 5 years old about the truth, quote unquote, truth about money? You know, it's like I'm moving forward with the brakes on or not at all. So I like how you said, you know, you can, this stuff allows you to deconstruct what your money story is, put together a way to over, you know, rewrite it and then sustain it. Skill acquisition is important, like for day trading, but imagine you put out a skill into learning how to fish, but because of your story, your brain keeps leading you to a lake with zero fish in it. So it doesn't matter how well you can fish, you're not going to catch anything. You know, same thing with money story.
Yeah.
It's like, it doesn't matter how good I am. You know, it's like your brain, you know, your money store is holding you back, so to speak. So
that's a great observation. And, you know, the founder of this whole deal of mentor coaching, Thomas Leonard, said, you know, we just have to be one step ahead of our clients. And sometimes a half step is enough.
Mm-hmm.
And especially in trading options and day trading, I think it's especially useful to really know how your mind and brain works. Is Andrew by any chance on the call? Andrew from Australia? He did New Money Story mentor training with me. He's a trader in Australia, and he trains other traders how to work and uses some of my material there, and he's developed a real program. So it certainly can be applicable, and I'll hook you guys up if you're interested in in that. So super.
Thanks, yeah.
Thank you for mentioning that. Anything else before we move to a lecture mode, and I will reserve some time at the end. I'm still open for some selective electives here. I am thinking about including some aspects of money biases, financial mistakes that we make, but I'm interested in any other responses before we move on, or questions.
Well, this is Carol again. I just quickly want to say a couple of things, because I don't know that I'm articulating it as clearly as I should be. But remember I mentioned at the beginning, I talked about this whole mindset of scarcity. Remember that? Really, at the very beginning. And so I've been very mindful of that. So something happened a couple of days ago where somebody called me, and a very dear friend, it's not an issue at all. But amazingly, my mind went right to that space. But now I'm mindful of the fact that, okay, so this is what you think when things like this happen. So actually, I have a meeting scheduled tomorrow with my financial advisor and sort of level this playing field and kind of move on with it and like just be mindful of the fact that this is a pattern of thinking that I've got to manage in a different way.
That sounds really important. Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt.
I'm sorry.
That sounds really important that you identified what I would refer to as an emotional trigger to look at how you create a different scenario to rewire your brain. Here's a resource that I think you might find beneficial to further that process. You may have seen it already. On the homepage of MentorPath is a webinar on master states of mind. You can access it by just, you know, entering your email and it's there. And specifically look at the neural conditioning chart, because what you're talking about is to create a different neural wiring for a specific trigger to get to an ideal behavior instead of the usual time capsule that contains the scarcity thinking, the negative self-talk, all the usual things that are in that time capsule. And by definition, a time capsule never changes. You can't, you know, strategize, therapize, or anything else to change what's in that time capsule, but you can rewire your brain to move to an ideal behavior. So that webinar is just a succinct way of looking at that might be of benefit.
Okay, and so what's it called again?
Okay.
What's it called? Just go to MentorPath?
Yes, MentorPath.com, MentorPath.com, my website. And it's right mm-hmm. there, front and center, a webinar called Master States of Mind.
Got it. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. I'm going to go to lecture mode, but I'll reserve some time at the end. Okay, we're going to talk about the last two steps of the roadmap and then some additional, as I mentioned, selective electives. Step six is to author new experiences. There are just some things I want to mention about that, because that's one of the things that we specialize in as mentor coaches is change. And we trust our stories. They're our reality. When our stories and our behaviors don't fit or don't work, we have disharmony. So we have to change one or the other, our stories or our behaviors. So sometimes we revise our story, sometimes we simply change the way we see reality. Now, we've considered if your story doesn't allow you to do certain things. If your story is that you're a procrastinator, it'll disallow you from finishing early. If your story says you don't do technology well, you'll live out this assumption. So let's look just briefly at the dynamics of change. First, the idea of change will create excitement, dopamine. Says, you know, what's next? Then, as it's on the cusp of action, perhaps anxiety. But remember that the brain doesn't know the difference between anxiety and excitement, so you have to actively frame it here. Then, expansion, and then finally, mastery. There are a couple of additional aspects of experiencing change that may seem paradoxical, but when you code your radar for it, you may begin to hear it in your clients or even see it in yourself. Every step forward means relinquishing a past position. And someone must mourn. They must say goodbye emotionally as well as practically to a familiar, maybe long-held and practiced old story. This is a process. It's a developmental step, not something you can just say and make it so or recognize it, change it. It's like saying goodbye to an old friend to give up a habit or a pattern of behavior, or a hope that by getting the old story just right or doing it better, it'll make it work. And no matter how maladaptive, the old story still has to be mourned. Now, remember, as you're working with yourself and with your clients, your client is not going to recognize the old story versus the new until you help them distinguish. It's not a story to the client. It's just the way things are. It's reality. So this is where we come into play to catalyze this process of self-reflection, as you've just heard. Each of the participants has said some version of this already. The second aspect, the more subtle aspect of learning something new and creating change is an injury to self-esteem. Now, that really does sound paradoxical. A carefully crafted old story, even with aspects of identity attached, is replaced by something better. So you've been doing this all along, and you realize suddenly something is better. So that's an adjustment in itself. So there are some components that I see in this dynamic of change. Now, you're not going to see these labeled by your clients. This is not something they're going to say outright. But these are just for you to think about as internal conceptual markers, because this is part of the developmental process of recognizing a story like a money story and creating a new one. The myth that there's a perfect choice. The illusion that the perfect choice will solve all problems. The disappointment that nothing's perfect. There isn't even an ultimate arbiter of fairness. And the scientific term of that is adulthood. The development. The recognition that no one's going to take care of it for you. Another aspect of adulthood. The growth. To take the next best action, to own your story. And finally, the consolidation, the happy, sad experience combined that may seem confusing because it occurs at the same time. There's a little forward slash mark in your experience between happy and sad. Happy about the autonomy and the mastery of moving ahead, the effectiveness of not creating an obstacle, and sad because you actually have to mourn an old story, including, and the hardest thing to give up, is what might have been. But that has to be mourned in taking that final step into the present. So, in looking at that then, there are just some aspects that I want to highlight for you, and we can discuss more of these as we have a discussion, but I want to just give you an illustration. You see in the outline, in the accompanying material, I just want to highlight some ABCs of financial mistakes, just so you'll become attuned to listening to those. This is a way of organizing some of the most common financial mistakes to get a level of understanding, because a compromised money behavior and financial decisions can fall, in one way of thinking about it, into one of four categories. The ABCs, affect or feeling, behavior, cognitive, or social biases. I want to just give you a couple of examples of each of these biases so you can begin to listen for these. The first, the affect or the emotional biases. An example here. And I think I've listed in the outline addendum like 25 or 27 of the most common ones, but here are just a couple of examples. Nostalgia bias. We feel more nostalgic at difficult times, and nostalgia remembers things not as they are, but as we wish them to be. Airbrushed memories backlit by idealization. Nostalgia recalls the ideal rather than the real. Has anyone gotten worse in high school and college sports as the years go on, or become less popular in memory replays? I'm really close to becoming All-State in basketball twice in one season, but probably by next year. And that was also the season we were undefeated, by the way, I think. Marketing taps into nostalgic experiences. It's easier and faster to associate with idealized memories than to create a new product identification. The nostalgic trigger is coupled with new information. For example, Arnold Palmer and that old tractor, two classics preserved by one particular motor oil. A second example, invincibility bias. This seemingly inextinguishable sense of immortality that we all have when we were young still has whispers in adulthood. And these are from some very well-established surveys. 19% of the population believe they're in the upper 1% of income. 90% of all drivers believe they're above average. I know here in Houston that's not true. 75% of people believe they're healthier than average. And the tech rally investors bought into in the late 1990s. And again, the mortgage debacle in 2008. A couple of examples of behavior biases. A term that I have coined, transference fallacy. In psychoanalysis, the tendency to redirect feelings from a past context to a current one is considered a type of transference. In other words, software that was developed for a previous time is maybe outdated, but you're still using it. An example, Digital Equipment Corporation posted a 13% decline, and Hewlett-Packard collapsed half of its value that same day. Totally unrelated to any of the fundamentals of Hewlett-Packard, but there was a transference of one supercomputer company to another. Spending justification, creating a just cause to spend. Somebody takes money from retirement savings to spend with the justification of an immediate need being greater than an abstract future need of retirement. So, the question when there's internal bargaining like this by the mentor coach may be, how will you repay it? Or it may be vaguely dismissed with a vow to return the money at some future point. That's not a plan. A status quo bias, a resistance to leaving a comfort zone. The status quo is another name for inertia. The default option is to stay in our comfort zone. Marketers know when they give a free 3-month trial, it's called a forced free trial when you don't ask for it. For example, each of you have experienced this or maybe even signed on for it. You get 3 free months of a magazine subscription, but you have to give your credit card first, and then the agreement is, unless you unsubscribe, they'll start charging you on the 4th month. Almost 80% of initial free subscribers stay on for the long haul of paid subscription. Less than 70% of people who stay on do not read the subscriptions, but they have the power of inertia, the status quo, because they don't initiate something different. Cognitive biases. Diagnosis bias. You label a person or a situation and then seek data to confirm more vigorously, coupled with a blindness to evidence that contradicts that. Here's a study that'll give an illustration of that. Two economists, Barry Starr and Ha Huang, studied skill categories and stats of new NBA players. They distilled these statistics into distinct skill-measuring categories, scoring, quickness, toughness. They looked at all the variables that determine playing time in games, injury, trade status, players' performance, skill categories. There was one variable, though, for the 5 years they did study, that for all the players that had greater impact than any of these actual performance data. It was the players' draft selection order. In fact, draft order was more highly correlated with playing time through the first 5 years in the NBA, which is as long as they studied these statistics. So you would think that skill and performance determines a draft order, but then once picked, coaches and managers should only be interested in the player's performance. In other words, once the draft is over, the draft number is history and performance is everything. Well, not so, says diagnosis bias. And I'm going to give you some other examples about the opportunity cost of money in just a bit. Social biases, the final of the ABCs. An affinity bias. We underestimate the risk of things we like. We overestimate the risk of things we don't like out-of-favor investments or foreign enemies. An example, you lose $20 betting a favorite in the Super Bowl. Well, that's unlucky. you lose $1,000 betting your alma mater will win their college game, even though they have the worst record in the conference. Affinity bias. And another of the social biases, loss aversion. Selling a loser of an equity admits defeat. We tend to avoid pain. There's about twice as much bad feeling, and it's measured in the brain, associated with losing $100 as there is a good feeling in gaining $100. Harry Markowitz won a Nobel Prize in economics for the mathematical breakthrough showing how to calculate a trade-off between risk and return in portfolio selection of stocks. He admitted, though, he couldn't apply it to his own portfolio. He said, "I visualized my grief if the stock market went up and I wasn't in, or if it went way down and I wasn't completely in it. My intention was to minimize my future regret." And we will hear maybe our discussion from our trader about the use of algorithms in trading to obviate or circumvent all of that. Now, I want to talk about the final step of the roadmap system and to look at some things to think about in terms of how to go about addressing those aspects of programming new identity. The change has to be incorporated as your true self, and the identity transformed of being in the new story. Not just creating it, but being in the story as if it is your true self, your true north. And this involves the ability to unlearn, to not engage a default neural connection. That's why the changes that really become permanent involve putting it in an output channel, not just theory, not just ideas, but putting it in an output channel. And at the same time, this is the new behavior side by side with the unlearning, because you're developing new neuronal networks and pathways. At the same time, you're not engaging the old ones. And that combination is what rewires your brain. So this is what we look at and focus on in coaching, in working with people to help them incorporate the changes they're making as part of their authentic self. So here's an example. We've touched on this before, but with our operating systems, we create two systems simultaneously. This is a bit redundant, but it's important here, especially as we're talking about the rewiring process. The surface story is what we are consciously and logically aware of. This may be what we want out of life, our goals, and that 5 or 10% that gives us a conscious focus. At the same time, an unconscious story can ghostwrite behaviors, sometimes in a different direction than conscious intention. Here's how that can sound. Well, I can't get what I want. The system keeps me from doing what I need. I don't think I have what it takes. So compromises occur when two money stories are written simultaneously. An example, I want to make more money and generate wealth. But the parallel story that comes from an earlier time in life, downloaded without even being consciously aware of it, from the way we see our parents regard money, the way we see them treat it, the ways we've come to learn in early time that gets repeated, money and autonomy means abandonment of my family or of my origin. It means not being who I really am. Or, as we heard the example, money equals scarcity. So the kind of things that we have automatically linked to various kinds of triggers and emotions can be really important to recognize. So, here are some frequent mistakes made in writing a new money story, all of which are incorporated in this transition to program a new story. One, not knowing you don't know. So how can people know that they don't know something? We believe we know, which blinds us to our ignorance. This in turn causes us to be unaware of signs that we may be mistaken. So to know, to ask is half the answer. You heard from the various responses just at the beginning of this seminar how that awareness can be crystallized by looking at things in a different way. That's what the workbook is designed to do, to have work tools of exercises that can more systematically address changes. Now, anytime you've heard me say, and I'll repeat again, anytime you truly want to affect change or break a habit or create a new habit, have a system. Not just the goal, that won't be enough, but have a system. Now, as I mentioned before, the neural conditioning chart is a micro system of how to look at an emotional trigger and get grounded and centered and move toward an ideal response, as I mentioned in the webinar on the homepage of MentorPath. The roadmap that we've been talking about for these four seminars is a macro system, a way to really deconstruct a story, to look at aspects that we may want to change or create a new story altogether and use those same components and understanding to create that new story. Second most frequent mistake, it's not really in order, but stopping at the first right answer. When we're solving problems or writing a new story, we may stop at the first reasonable action. Now, this could be a correct strategy, but it may also stop us from considering other right answers, other correct strategies that could be even more effective. So we may need to ask or maybe nudge a client, and then what? Or what else? Okay, number three, I'm going to address with a brief quiz. Five frogs sat on a log. They all considered their options. Four, though, planned their strategy, created a system, and decided they would jump off. So how many were left? Well, five were left because they only planned and decided and didn't commit to act. So you need a plan, and you need to do it. Number three is procrastination. So I'm talking about some of the broad themes here, the big patterns. Putting off an exercise program, not paying yourself first, not saving for emergencies, not saving for retirement, taking care of others but not yourself. Most of us live our lives as though there were an unlimited amount of time left. We may have little sense of urgency that can contribute to lack of a focus. An example here. When the two-minute warning sounds in football, a team sometimes achieves more in that final 2 minutes than it did in the previous 28 in that half. This imminent deadline, a limited, finite amount of time to accomplish goals, focuses concentration and increases effort. In our lives, we only rarely have a two-minute warning. We play as if the notion of finite time is only an abstraction, something we acknowledge but may not internalize. Life is finite. It's just that the game clock is invisible. Four, inefficient energy management. Managing energy is a key to success. This begins with knowing your strengths, your biological cycles, when you perform best, how to create deliberate practice for optimum performance. And as you'll see in the webinar, so I won't go into it in more detail here, but how to optimally enter a state of mind and sustain that zone of performance. And also identify what depletes your energy, such as toxic people or situations, negative mindset, lack of focus. Five, ambiguity. If you're unclear about what options are available, then you're not clear about what specifically to select, to pursue, to focus on. Eating a healthier diet, saving for the future. That's a great idea, but it's vague, it's indirect. When you want to affect change, you need to script specific behaviors. 6, too many choices. At some point, choice deliberation can debilitate rather than liberate, and someone retreats to a default mode of not making a choice. Think about how when you look at something, you have all kind of possibilities, and it just seems like, where do I start from here? So you just promptly take a nap. I mean, it's a choice, but it really retreats from too many choices. Here's a classic study that initiated this whole science of decision paralysis. It was done and you probably heard about this. It was done at a gourmet grocery store. The research project offered a display of 6 jams for tasting. Then on an alternate weekend, there were 24 jams available for tasting. Both weekends, customers were given a coupon for $1 off as they purchased any jam. This was done at gourmet grocery stores, you know, in various parts of the country. When 24 varieties were available for testing, 3% were purchased. When only 6 varieties were available for tasting, 30% purchased. Too many choices resulted in a tenfold decline of actual purchases. With too many choices, we just feel overwhelmed and resort to our comfort zone, which is to do nothing. 7, lack of persistence. A truly challenging, courageous part of change is not the initial action or the initiation of a new order of things. It's willingness to stay the course. 1 extra degree of effort in business and in life can separate the good from the great. 51 publishers turned down Richard Bach to publish Jonathan Livingston Seagull. He took it to number 52. 141 publishers turned down a guy who then decided to publish his book himself and sell it out of the back of his car. It had a really goofy title for a book, Chicken Soup for the Soul. Jack has now sold $1.5 billion worth of books. Lord Eliot put it this way, perseverance is not a long race. It's many short races, one after another. 8, not following success trails. Pick success trails you want to follow. Watch someone who's doing what you might want to do. Ask him, take them to lunch and pick their brain or shadow them for a day to observe. But make it your story. Take all the information and construct your own story from your own point of reference. 9, believing it's unspiritual to make significant money. There doesn't have to be a split between spirituality and money. They can exist quite compatibly. There's nothing intrinsically unspiritual about money. It's one of those assumptions like starving artists. Why would someone of exceptional talent have difficulty converting that ability into significant income? So here's now an overview, a brief overview of the 7 steps. So we've examined your money story as money of reality and metaphor, the path as well as the possession of money, and the power we give money and its own power. Now, we've engaged in a journey to illuminate and change that money story. We've reviewed these 7 steps. Recognize authorship. Own your money story. Assess the plot and storylines. Decide what to change. Map changes. Author new experiences. And program new identity. In these 7 steps, we've articulated some of the secret language of money, how some money issues are really about money, and how a bunch of other things hitchhike on money, and how our money stories are a large part of our life stories. These basic steps deconstruct how you write your money story and live it. They're the building blocks to revise a money story or write a new one. So let's apply that now in terms of engineering effectiveness in this reprogramming. Some brief reviews of essentials of engineering an effective new money story. One, make changes tangible and concrete. Construct a yardstick or a map to determine where you are, where you're going, and to be able to measure progress along the way and to tell what's detour and distraction. That's what a goal does. That's what a map does. Two, make your progress measurable. A specific destination with a tangible focus on the next step. Three, make progress visible. Small, specific, attainable milestones that are visible and a celebration of each small victory. Specify the next step, not abstract or global. Some is not a number. Soon is not a time. Act healthier is not a strategy. And all you ever have to do in life is the next right thing. This shrinks change to immediate steps of effectiveness and the experience of momentum. One of the best examples that I've heard of shrinking a task to its tangible next focus is Alcoholics Anonymous, challenging its members to one day at a time. It shrinks the change to a manageable, foreseeable, specific action. A small target leads to small victories, the cumulative experience of effectiveness and mastery. So we've just adopted the scientific measure and method to examine, to measure, to test, to consider change. It's a challenge to create a mindset of inquiry generates discomfort, but it also catalyzes growth. A recent study found something really important. The more clearly and fully you can picture your future self, the more money you'll save for the future. Emily Pronin did this research at Princeton, found that people who could visualize their future self would save three times as much for retirement, age 70 and on. And Stanford developed age progression software to show that when people were shown the aging process, they began to save about the same amount of money, two to three times. When they did aging progression software to show what it would be like if they continued to smoke versus stopping to smoke, if they continued to gain a pound each year versus if they stayed in shape, it was amazing because there's no way to not see what you see. So here's a brief review of some guidelines. Listen for the story that the source within you tells. Tell your story the way you want it to be in order to actualize it. Plan it, map it, and initiate its creation. Whatever you're living or experiencing in any way is in response to the story you're telling. If you want the story to change, you have to change the way you tell that story so that it shifts your feeling and thinking as you're telling it. This means that responses from others are not in the equation of that creation. You have your own internal point of reference. You're taking in information, gathering all kind of data, but you are the reference point. You are the protagonist of your story. And whatever you think and feel and experience, you create each moment. This new telling has to be in alignment with who you are, especially with your needs and ideals, in order to have a complete energy field and a full, purposeful direction of that field going forward. When you practice the story that resonates with who you really are, your full energy and power becomes activated. You also have to not give away your power. All of you is going in the same direction. When that occurs, know the direction you're going and the goal and strategies of that pathway. When you do that, there'll be nothing stopping you. Know that you can keep telling and living a better story no matter how good your story is now. The universe will resonate with and match your story as you live it. So here's something I wanted to add, just you know, on the basis of something that Joy said, just to consider the opportunity costs of money. It's not something we usually think about. What's the most common money mistake that we make? Think about that for a moment. I've already given you the answer, obviously. I should have done it a little bit differently. I could have kept the mystery alive for a moment. Money decisions become more complicated because of opportunity lost. And this is something we don't usually consider. By accounts of behavioral economists and neuroeconomists, it's the most common money mistake that we make. The often omitted aspect of making choices is that we must choose what not to do with money at the same time we choose what to do with it. This is the shadow story, the invisible component that's usually not considered adequately. Opportunity costs are the things that we lose, that we give away now or later in order to do something now, the opportunities that we sacrifice when we make a choice. This means that when we spend money on one thing, we can't spend it on something else. Here's a really simple example. You have a dollar. You're in front of a choice of an apple for a dollar or an orange for a dollar. The opportunity is to buy one. The opportunity cost is that you won't be able to have the other. We give up an opportunity that dollars can provide now or in the future when we make a choice to spend on a specific item. Let's broaden that example. Let's say you have $500 each week beginning on Monday, and that's all you can spend. No going into debt, no other income, $500. In the beginning of the week, you may not consider what you're giving up later in the week by having a dinner and a drink and buy an expensive shirt. By Friday, though, you're looking at the whole weekend ahead, and you've got $42 left. It's a tough choice left on Sunday to either buy the New York Times or a bagel with the remaining money and to remember that dinner, drink, and that Monday shirt. On Monday, there was an opportunity cost to consider, but it really wasn't clear, wasn't in conscious focus. It wasn't in the foreground of thought of conscious choice or decision. Sunday, the opportunity cost is really clear, but it's too late. Now, expand that week and that $500 into a money figure for your money story and your life span, and think seriously about that. Opportunity costs are what we should think about as we make financial decisions. The reason that this is the biggest money mistake, we usually don't think about it as a conscious choice. We don't consider our money as a closed system. We kind of bargain, well, I'll save some Tuesday or I'll always make more money. A finite resource where one choice affects the other. That's a closed system. Opportunity costs are not just restricted to money. There's some other examples I won't go into, but a behavioral economist, Dan Ariely, whose work I follow, did a study in which his group went to a Toyota dealership to interview people who were considering the purchase of a new vehicle. This is a terrific application of this, I think. And he interviewed the shoppers who considered what the dollars they would spend on a new car could be if they spent it on something else. All that each of them considered was what a new car would cost. He each asked each of the participants what particular services or product they would not be able to buy if they purchased that vehicle. Almost all people answered if they bought a Toyota, they wouldn't be able to buy a Honda or some other simple substitution. It was thinking categorically. They hadn't thought about what they wouldn't be able to spend on eating out, travel, paying for college. They were seemingly unable or unwilling to think of the money they were about to spend as their potential ability to buy a sequence of experiences or goods over time in the future. This is because money is so abstract in general, we have a hard time imagining opportunity costs or taking them into account. Basically, nothing specific comes to mind when we spend money except things that we're contemplating buying, because that activates, when we anticipate buying something, that activates the pleasure chemical dopamine. It's the anticipation of buying that creates that pleasure. And consider what happens when we look at the future, saving for the future, the abstract notion of a retirement fund. no chemical reaction occurs. It's just an abstract thought. So that's where you may have to outsmart your brain. So a component of choice is what we focus on now and how accurate that is in terms of the system that we operate. Let's go back for just a minute to that $500 a week person. That person walks out of a store and says, I just saved $40. The money is on, the focus is on the money saved. Well, this is specifically inaccurate. She did not save $40. She spent $47.50. If she were to save $40, she would take the $40 from that pile of $500 for this week and put it in savings account. To not spend is not the same as saving. That's also the way we make some purchase decisions, to look at the amount of reduction from the sales price and purchase a bargain without an absolute assessment of actual cost. This is an example of relativity. We compare the current cost relative to the amount that it supposedly used to cost before the sale. That $40 saved should not be compared to the $64 price tag and the focus on the $24 saved in this example, but the opportunity cost that spending $47.50 would mean in terms of what can't be bought. So back to that lobster that we talked about. If you go into a restaurant with all the a nice restaurant, all the available entrees, $17 to $24, and you see a lobster on sale for $5.95, or deeply discounted caviar at a restaurant. So, or the cardiovascular surgeon who offers extremely inexpensive heart surgery. So as you think about this and relativity, think about what you charge for your professional fees and what it says about you, what it says about your self-valuation. Okay, I'm going to move to discussion mode, so if you'll manage background noise, I'm interested in your thoughts on this. Okay, we're in discussion mode. If you'll be aware of background noise, thoughts or questions. There's a bunch of stuff we covered in some different directions, so it wasn't just a synopsis of the final two steps and the roadmap. But any thoughts, questions? Is this making sense to you?
Very much so. This is Carolyn again. Very much so. Can I just tell you? You know, when I'm listening to you talk about it, and I'm listening for the underlying neurochemistry piece of it, and what I'm really mindful of is this idea of, you know, the same response to a drug addiction is essentially what's happening in the brain when you're dealing with money stories. So
yes,
that's just a whole new way of looking at it that I hadn't considered, but
That's why some things are contagious. When you're with a group of people who are spending more, you spend more than you planned on, and why after you buy something on a shopping trip, you're much more likely to buy a second and a third and a fourth thing because you've already entered that mindset, the experience of the excitement of buying, and you do things to sustain that. That's why also when you have the cheesecake with strawberry topping, it's not that you just have a bite and then make a decision, like in the Ben Fletcher study, am I going to have this next bite? Is it in my best interest? You just go on automatic pilot and eat the rest of the thing, not remembering that in 80 to 90% of the actual flavor and pleasure is in the first three bites. After that, it's redundant, and you're just in a mindset that you don't really experience it fully. So same with money. So
yeah.
Great point. Thank you for mentioning that. There's a blog that I've posted since we began this series of my own personal story of such matters. It's my most recent blog that is about Russell Stover chocolate-covered cherries. And it's a benefit to anybody who's trying to break a bad habit. So I'd recommend that. There's a way to also sign on, leave your email so you get the blog delivered whenever I post it. I don't inundate you with blogs if you want to receive it in your email box. So, other thoughts, other questions?
Dave, I have a question.
I'm not sure I heard who either was, but go ahead and we'll return to the guy who I didn't hear. Go ahead, please.
Okay, this is Joy, and this is just a direct question and a request for reference. Now that I understand this money story, I know I'll be able to go back and identify where this thought from, but can you direct me to what would be helpful for realizing or giving away money, being in the habit of feeling like you have more, so, and knowing that more, actually, if I attach it to where it should go or how I should spend it, then I realize that I wouldn't give it away, but there's a desire for when there's a need or what appears to be a need around me, usually attached to people, that I give, realizing there's yet still responsibilities that I have and I'm taking away from my savings, from my retirement. What's a good direction to go in there? Because it's not an easy fix.
Okay, that's very true. Your check is in the mail before I even give this answer. You will be receiving a notice. My newest book, sequel to The Secret Language of Money, is being released tomorrow. It's called Your New Money Story, The Beliefs, Behaviors, and Brain Science to Rewire for Wealth. It's published by Roman and Littlefield, New York, London. But it's released tomorrow, and you're going to get a link to purchase it on Amazon, and tomorrow's the first day that it's out. So it's a really timely question, and I promise to everyone else I did not set up that question, although it would have been a good idea if I had. There was another, if you guys don't mind going over just a couple of minutes, there was another question. There was a guy who spoke. Go ahead, please.
This is Victor. Yeah, I guess just really quick. I take it, in the end, it's the environment is always going to trigger all these money stories in us via association. So like you said, having a system in place, just being watchful, having a system in place, right? Because it's always going to get triggered every time we act on it. It's like we're feeding it, you know, and perpetuating it. So
no. My short answer is no. There will always be triggers. But the work that you can do is for that to not be triggering or state changing, because the nanosecond that an emotional trigger actually activates a state change, that's when you've fallen into that time capsule, that silo of the old responses, the old story, and that will not change. But there is a way to rewire your brain for that trigger to be wired ultimately to an ideal response, and to get grounded and centered as a way of doing that and pre-planning that. Look at the Master States of Mind webinar, because that really is what that's about. There's a neuroconditioning chart that four simple steps, the micro system of changing exactly what you said, because we can't change the things that serve as triggers in the real world. But we can change our internal response and have an idea, have a way of getting grounded and centered, have that be more and more instantaneous, and have an ideal behavior pre-planned. So the more that we do this over time, it becomes hardwired. Just as whatever happened to hardwire that emotional trigger to respond in a way that is not productive initially, this is a way to override that, to consciously and systematically create a way to rewire your brain.
Okay, that's what I was curious about. There's some. There's a system in place we can have. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I have called in, and this is the title of a next book on stress mastery and peak performance. It's a hard work miracle because it takes time and persistence, but it seems like a miracle when you do it because you totally rewired your brain and achieved a peak performance instead of getting hooked in that old and redundant cycle.
Right. Okay.
So thank you. Thank you all for your participation and your energy. I want to mention, I didn't have anybody to set this up, although it would have worked well. Now, we can keep on meeting like this. Next Monday, I'm doing another CTA four-part teleseminar series on neuromarketing. It's applying the mind and brain sciences to marketing your services and products to about influence psychology, persuasion neuroscience, success mindset, and neuromarketing. Those are the four seminars. So you can go to CTA and sign up for that, and we can keep on meeting like this. And for those of you who decide to, I'll see you next Monday evening. Thanks so much for all of your participation and responses. I appreciate it very, very much. And I totally enjoy doing this with you guys. Thanks again.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you so much, Dave. We appreciate it. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you.